The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
Wake up in the morning. I don't feel blue. Cause I know I've got you. Getting a funny feeling. All day and night, get the funny feeling. You don't treat me right. Should've read your letter, and then I know I would've felt much better. Because I know you love me so.
It's just we never did that big good, but I mean it's
because I know you love me so.
But we always just.
Because I know I love it so.
Wake up in the morning, I don't feel blue. Cause I know I've got you. Just a funny feeling all day and night. Get the funny feeling, you don't treat me right. Should've read your letter, and then I know I would've felt much better. Because I know you love me so.
Welcome to SATB 224A of A through C 224, which we will be parceling out over the next couple of weeks. So you're going to get boom, 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 feast or famine with this show, folks. Anyway, it is a timely thing this holiday season with Christmas, Hanukkah, Thanksgiving. And speaking of Thanksgiving, wasn't that a Thanksgiving to be grateful for? What was given to us on Disney Plus, the initial installment of Peter Jackson's long-awaited 4 years in the making Get Back film. Now, we have done several shows, as you know, as was pointed out recently, on the Let It Be story, the making of the film, the January 1969 project, going into what was called at the time The Beatles at Work, before Get Back materialized along the way. We've come at it at all kinds of angles, particularly with the guests Dan Rifkin of They May Be Parted blog and Duncan Driver. And we tried to do as much as we could in advance without actually seeing the film by way of analyzing the lay of the land and where we thought, knowing what we knew, Peter Jackson should go with it. Now it's here. Now we've all seen it. expect some of you have seen it more than once. There will be a number of shows to come, at least a couple, just sort of analyzing the finished film, what we thought about it, and just sort of giving our take on it. And you'd expect no less, right, from Satby? But for this show, we're going to talk about the making of and give you guys some insight into the challenges of the actual production of this, the 4 years in the making, what it took, what the intent was, and where it came out. We thought it would probably be helpful for this discussion to have somebody connected with the production of the film to talk about what went on behind the scenes, because we're very limited beyond the few interviews that Peter Jackson has done over the course of summer and the little clips that have leaked out. All this building this great anticipation. So we needed to find somebody who can give us an informed perspective on the work it took. Come to find out, there was a listener out there that was paying attention to what we were saying on the show, paying attention to the riffing on the Let It Be project, especially between Duncan, Dan, and myself, and was just dying to get in on the conversation. He let it be known. I said, fine. Here's the platform. The floor is yours. Have at it. This came at the end of the media blitz in the week coming into the release of the documentary. So we had to arrange to get this done before the documentary actually was screened, because he very much wanted our perspective and discussion to be focused on going into it. He was going to offer the making of, we'd respond back with our questions and commentary and all that sort of thing. He didn't want our reaction to it yet. That'll come later. I was able to get Dan, who was on vacation in California on short notice. Unfortunately, Duncan was trapped in a commitment that he could not get out of. So our best to you, Duncan. We'll get you next time. Anyway, we decided to have the discussion when we had the window to do it with this person connected to the film. I will now turn the floor over to Peter Jackson.
Most of the interviews I do are like 10 minutes long. They literally are 10 minutes and they're terrible. You've read a lot of them probably recently online. I mean, they're just, you try to do as much as you can in 10 minutes. And you half the time you're talking to people that haven't got a bloody clue what's what the whole thing is. So, you know, so I'm looking forward to this because it's nice to talk to people that actually have some knowledge, probably more than I do, in very many regards, more than I do.
Well, we'll find that out. But I really think that you got, through the course of the last 4 years, a unique entree into this world that has been, if not suppressed, certainly kind of swept under the rug by the Beatles themselves, that they didn't know what they had. Maybe Michael Lindsay Hogg did at one time, but it just seems like everybody's take on January 1969 was shaped by the final edit of Let It Be, and that's what came out, and that's the narrative they've been running with.
Yeah, the final edit of Let It Be and the emotional climax when it was actually finally released. Yeah, you know. To be fair, I think it's more the emotional landscape when it was released than it is the actual edit. I mean, if you look at Let It Be now, it's not really that bad. It's not the terrible doom and gloom breakup movie. So I don't really think it's the edit of what Michael did with it. He had a problem that the 16mm to 35 blow up in 1970 wasn't that great. It was grainy and it lost, it sort of desaturated. It kind of lost its colors a little bit. So it was a bit, so the visual look of it was a bit gloomy. So once you start with a slightly gloomy looking film and then you pile on the breakup and you pile on everything else, then you're having a bit of a, you know, you've drawn the short straw. I feel sorry for Michael. But what I think with this project, what I hope, you know, and I really sincerely hope that this doesn't become a, gosh, Michael stuffed it up and Peter got it right. No, not that I necessarily did. I've never seen it yet, you guys. But I hope it doesn't become that, because that would be unfair to Michael. Because if people like anything I've done, I'm using Michael's footage. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm using Michael Lindsay Hogg's film, the stuff he shot. And so if anybody gives me credit for anything, that's shared with Michael Lindsay Hogg. So, you know, I don't think it's going to be at all fair if people assign Michael Lindsay Hogg to Let It Be 1970 and I'm get back 2021, because that's just not fair. In very many respects, Michael is a partner in Get Back as much as anything. So I hope that people have a balanced sort of attitude towards it, because it would be very, very unfair to Michael. And Michael's been incredibly supportive of me all the way through this project too. So I just, you know, anyway, we can talk about all this as we go along. I'm sure it's a topic we can dig into with a lot more depth, just the whole, you know, what Michael shot, how he shot it, and how I've used it really is the thing, isn't it? That's the key to it all.
Michael's almost a co-star in the film. When you listen, or at least when I listen to the tapes, he's a co-star as far as the people involved. And I wondered how you would attack that when it finally came to making your film.
Well, completely. I mean, you see, the thing when you're making a movie like Michael shot and then he cut Let It Be together, you tend to not put yourself in your own film if you're a director. Even if it's a documentary and you've got these cameras a bit unpredictable, kind of shooting different thing, different angles. So sometimes I can't remember seeing Let It Be a couple of times in the last, three, 4 years. I can't particularly remember Michael how much he's in it or not. But if he's in it, it's sort of by mistake. He just happens to be standing somewhere where one of the cameras catches him. But, that's not yet the intention. But in our movie, I mean, I always went into our movie with a philosophy that we're showing Michael trying to make his film. I mean, we have multiple storylines. We've got the Beatles trying to write and compose and record these songs or plan for a show and then end up recording them in Savile Row. We've got the interaction and personal relationships between the Beatles. We've got Michael with two cameras trying to film a film while all this other stuff's going on, planning a show. Where's the show going to be? I mean, it's got multiple story threads through it. And Michael certainly is one of them. And to be honest, that's one of the ones I enjoy the most, because as a filmmaker, I like it because I see him suffering so much. Not because I like Michael suffering, but I kind of, for me, it's entertaining seeing another director tearing his hair out silently. He keeps a pretty stiff upper lip and a good humor about it, but I can really feel for the poor guy. You know, he's trying to pin them down. They're like little wriggly worms that refuse to get pinned down. It's like, so are we going to do this? It's, you know, they have a discussion about where they're going to do it. And at the end of the day, and everyone's going to absolutely, yep, we're going to do this. So is that an agreement? You know, and just when he wants them all to say yes, they say, well, let's sleep on it overnight and tomorrow we'll come in and we'll tell you tomorrow. He's tried to pin them down. Of course, tomorrow morning it's like, oh, we've gone off that idea now. It's kind of poor guy. It's sort of vaguely, in a sadistic way, I like seeing this Michael sort of struggling. But I do feel for him. I think I'd go insane if it was me.
I love that in the clips you've released so far, you've got that bit in there where he says,
"The documentary is just grinding to a halt."
Grinding to a halt? I think it's taking off.
Here we go.
Michael's very, very funny. He's also very blunt. I mean, one of my favorite Michael lines, and I probably won't get this right, but it's basically along the lines of some point, it's in Savile Row, one of the Beatles says to him, because they're kind of almost teasing him. It's their best interest that Michael's making the best film possible, because it's their movie, they're paying for it. But they kind of are almost enjoying him struggling. They know that they're making it hard for him. And they're kind of, so it's a really weird cat and mouse sort of a game. Anyway, one of them says to Michael, "So how's the film going, Mike?" And Mike says, "Well, if it's going to be a movie about nose picking, chain smoking, and ass scratching, it's going really well." I mean, that's the way he talks to them. He has no respect for them at all. It's all just done in good fun. I think Paul McCartney says, "Yes, Michael, we're very, very uncouth people, aren't we?" It's done in all good humor, but it's sort of it's very, 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 very entertaining. Michael's suffering in the hands of the Beatles is sort of partly they're enjoying it, and as the audience, we kind of enjoy it too.
Sure. It's funny because on the one hand, I don't know how much footage there is accompanying the audio that we've had, and Dan has done a great job of dissecting it. I was wondering, well, before I go down that question, I was going to ask you, did you, prior to 2017, prior to having any inkling that this was going to come your way, have a great deal of familiarity with the stuff that was out there, such as the A.B. Road bootleg series of all the Niagaras? Did you read the Doug Sulpey book, Drugs, Divorce, and the Slipping Image? Had you that kind of familiarity with it?
I hadn't familiarity with the book or the A.B. roles by the time I started. What I had is familiarity and was like 30 years of collecting bootlegs. Vinyl at the beginning, like, you know, I think the Black Album was the first Get Back bootleg I got, which is back in 1980s, maybe late 80s or something. And then after that, I collected as many bootlegs as I could. And for a few years, it was vinyl. And they used to release Get Back Sessions, box set vinyl. I mean, you know, this with about, you know, six vinyl LPs in there in a box, and, you know, flimsy sort of box. And very, I mean, there was lots of them. There was lots of them. And then they flicked into CDs at some point. So in the last few years, I haven't really paid much attention to what the bootleg scene's like. And because I was busy on other things. And also, I used to be, honestly, I used to find the Get Back Session bootlegs kind of interminable. I won't claim that I listened to any of them all the way through. I mean, maybe the Black Album, because it was the first one I got, and I was highly excited about it. But I would collect them. I mean, I'd collect other bootlegs, and listen to those, especially when all the good stuff started to come out on CD, all the Abbey Road session stuff. I listened to all that. And anyway, when we started this project, when I began to look at all the stuff that Apple was giving me, you know, when I sort of got on board it, I got the Sulpy book then. That's proved as a reference book is incredibly helpful to us because it tells us where we can find songs. And also we can look at each day. I mean, I'm certainly be very grateful for that book. I think it has problems in hindsight now that I know what I know, but nonetheless, it doesn't take away from its incredible usefulness as a reference source for us. And the AB box set, what, about 30-odd discs, 35 or something, 35 discs. We bought that when we were underway, and I had a poor assistant editor go through all of our Nagras, you know, all the Nagras from Apple, in case there was something that wasn't on the Nagras, because there's still 40 Nagras that are missing, you see. So I wanted to establish, because that's about 10 hours of audio that's missing, and I wanted to establish whether that 10 hours actually has appeared on any bootlegs. So I said, can you just go through this and compare it with it doesn't appear that those 40 missing Nagras have ever been on a bootleg. We can't find any bootlegs ever, and Apple can't either, that contains the audio from those 40 missing Nagras. I managed to find some myself through a separate means, which I can talk about. We got about three hours of it, so there's still about seven hours missing. But the 3 hours we got some quite good stuff on it that's never been heard before. So,
do you know off the top of your head what days those were?
They're all over the place. I mean, not off the top of my head, but I do have all that information. I mean, if you want it separately to this, I'll certainly get it for you, because I know that you guys are good. You know, it should be in the record. All the work that we've been done is forensic work. We're going to give it all back to Apple to their files, but I'm happy to hand it over to people that have a serious interest in it, because we've done 4 years of work on this, and it shouldn't stay with us. I don't think it's 40 tapes in a row, in a clump. I think they're dotted all over the place. We do have that. I mean, we have the records of exactly where the missing Nagras are, because we've strung it all together in a really forensic way. And so if we hit a spot where there's audio missing, and sometimes there's picture, so you're getting just mute picture, but sometimes it's audio missing where there's no picture, so it doesn't really matter so much, apart from the fact that there's no audio there. But we do know exactly these spots where it's missing. I mean, I can tell you one, because we use some of it in the cut, is the first day at Savile Row, the first day back at Savile Row. The first day at Savile Row in the movie and Michael's footage is the second day at Savile Row. They start at Savile Row on a Monday. I can't remember the date, so it's a Monday. But they don't allow cameras because they're still installing the gear from EMI. They haven't finished installing the gear. The Beatles decide they're going to go in there and rehearse anyway. And George Harrison, it's the first day back for him. Michael's not allowed to film anything. I think mainly because they had all the EMI guys trying to install the gear in the studio, and there was limited space, and I'm sure they didn't really want a whole camera crew piling in on top of all that. And so they let cameras come in on the Tuesday, which is really the Beatles' second day. And the first thing you hear is Michael Lindsay Hoggart, who wasn't there on the Monday, says to them, "Oh, how did it go?" And Ringo says, "Fantastic. You know, we worked till 7:30 on the Monday." And then George Harrison comes by. Remember, we haven't really seen much of him since he quit. And he said, "Yeah, good vibes, man, good vibes." And he's excited. So that's on film. It's on camera. But without the missing audio that we found, it would have just been mute. It would have just been talking with no sound. So I was pleased that we found that. But there's a bit of bathroom window on that first Savile Row, on the first day we have at Savile Row, day 12, there's a chunk of bathroom window. We use a little bit of that. I mean, I'm not sure what's on the bootlegs and what's on our missing stuff. I can't remember it all now, you know. But
yeah. Was there moments of where you had the film where you were not able to recover the audio that you wanted to use?
Well, the trouble is you don't know what the audio is.
My next question is, did you maybe bring in a lip reader?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. A lot of it's performing stuff. I didn't really go there because it's just too hard. It's like there's certainly plenty of audio that we use that we didn't have film for. That was certainly a thing. But when you have the film and no audio, it's like, what can you do? It's like you're not going to have people impersonating the Beatles. If there was anything useful in that we could use to... Because we had to find pictures to put over the missing, because I didn't want to have black slugs. You know, I didn't want to sort of suddenly the film to go black and just have no picture available. I mean, even though if you were a documentarian, historian, that's what you do, but that's not quite what we're doing. We're trying to make a film that people can watch. So if there was a conversation, you know, say, you know, 30-second conversation that we really wanted to use that didn't have any picture, we'd find on the same day, because you have to stick day by day because that clothes change every day. So you can't sneak a picture from a different day onto this day because it would never work. And you wouldn't want to either. So we'd look through that day for spare picture that we weren't using. And maybe it was even maybe a piece of film with no sound, who knows. And so you'd try to find a wide shot from the back of the studio with just a group of them saying something, and then you'd put that over the top of this conversation. You know, you put something innocuous that didn't really tip things one way or the other, but at least hear them talking, and you look at them just in the group there, and you think, I'm having a chat, you know. So
that reminds me of the battle scenes in They Shall Not Grow Old, where you use the magazine covers for the visual.
Yeah, that was one way of doing it. I mean, that was missing battle scenes. But we do have plenty of shots of the Beatles that we weren't using. I mean, 56, 57 hours, and we're only using eight hours. So we've got plenty of spare unused picture of them. So we had no problem. I mean, it's better to put that on than put sort of drawings or pictures or anything else. You may as well, you know, if you're going to put a drawing or picture on, you may as well put a shot of the Beatles on. I mean, I was very careful not to tilt something one way or the other. I mean, if it was a conversation which sounded pretty serious, I wouldn't put pictures of them all laughing like crazy guys. I would always be very careful to try to keep it in the right mood. You know, we prioritized, obviously, when we were editing, we prioritized the stuff that we had picture and sound for to start with. So it was only when we absolutely had to use some audio because of the story we were telling that we'd have to then try and find some pictures to go with it.
On the subject of missing audio, it's well known to people who've studied the Niagaras that you hear the audio of George walking out on January 10th, leaving the group, when? Now. And it immediately cuts off. It seems so deliberate, like somebody had their finger on the recorder. Uh-oh, I better kill this right now. Were you able to find more of that particular day in that audio?
Well, it's a little bit more than that. I think it might cut and then start up again from memory. And all that stuff's on camera too. You know, you heard the audio, but Michael was filming it too. I think it goes, I'm leaving the group now or something. When now? And then it goes, I think there might be a cut then. And then it starts up again pretty quick. The cameraman stopped and then started again. It probably only missing a few seconds because you've got George talking to Mal, and there's that bit about put an ad in the NME and you'll get somebody to replace me, Mal. And that's filmed as well. You've got George and Mal talking, and you've got John standing pretty staunch. He's just sort of eavesdropping. He's right in the conversation. He's hearing what they're saying, and he's looking like he's sort of not challenging George, but he's kind of there. You know, I'm not too impressed by this, George. He's got the body language of somebody who's saying, are you really serious, mate? And then you hear Tony Richmond's voice, or maybe Pete Sutton, who's the sound recorder, saying, are you still rolling? Yeah, okay, let's cut. And it cuts. That's the end of the leaving, both audio and picture. The next time they roll film and tape, it's when they've just arrived back from lunch. I think that you hear them saying, I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know why we've come back now. I think that's what the first bit of audio is along those lines. I don't know why what we're doing coming back here. I think that's the very first line that said. I think it's John rather than Paul. But yeah, I think that's the first line you hear, and that's when they just returned back from lunch.
And what ensues is just a very bizarre moment where you've got John talking with Michael Lindsay Hogg about getting Clapton in, and Paul banging away on Martha, My Dear in the background, and then Yoko wants a mic.
Yeah, no, there's a version of that. You'll see that in the cut. We had a lot of fun cutting that. The after lunch events. But I tell you what you see, and this is an interesting thing where, you know, I came to have a huge understanding, I guess, and I think you guys too will too when you see this film, of how important the pictures are, because you think, you know, you've heard all the Niagaras, we've forensically gone through the Niagaras, and you think you kind of know the story kind of pretty much, but it came to realize once you see the pictures, a whole other aspect of it. It's partly why I keep banging on in interviews about how it's a lot happier and it's not what you think it is, because it's the pictures. I mean, if I was just working on the same Niagara as what everyone's had for decades, I wouldn't probably be saying that. It's the pictures that do it. But what I was going to say is, in that afternoon thing, the Clapton, and we're going to split George's instruments up and all this sort of stupid John Bravado stuff that happens. That day ends, and you wouldn't know this on the Niagaras. It ends with them in a hug. The three of them are hugging each other. They've got their arms around each other, and they're clearly in some form of distress at the end. All that macho, northern, scouse sort of bravado, Clapton, oh, yeah, sing, oh, and they sing this up. It wears off during the afternoon, and you see John just sitting by himself in a state of total depression. Ringo's sitting with Maureen looking absolutely destroyed and devastated. Paul is next to George Martin, George Martin's talking to Neil and Michael, but Paul's just sitting there looking kind of so depressed. And then their day sort of ends with them putting their arms around each other. So the pictures have a whole different story to tell. It's really, I mean, it's a fascinating subject, fascinating topic of how sound is one tells one story and picture has its own story, but the two together obviously give you the most accurate sense of all, you know. It wouldn't be accurate with the pictures only, because, of course, how would you do this out? The sound is vital, but it certainly completes the most accurate version of events you'll ever get, you know, unless you were there. And the thing is, if you were there, as I've discovered, today you won't remember a thing, because no one was who was there seems to remember anything about it. So we should probably if we were all there and we were talking today, we'd probably sit here thinking, I haven't got a clue. I can't remember that. I can't remember that.
That was actually a question I had for you was, and you basically answered it, was the leap from the printed word of what happened, whether it was in the original book package with Let It Be or something like Selfie, the leap from that to listening to the raw Niagara tapes, the bootlegs, is large. You know, you get such a fuller story. And I wondered how greater the story gets fleshed out going from just the audio to the audio and the video and or the audio and the film. And you answered it right there.
Well I mean, obviously it varies. Obviously you can listen to the audio and you look at the pictures and it's exactly what you were imagining in your head. You know, they're talking about something and you can get a visualization in your head and what you see the pictures is exactly the same. But on the other hand, there's a lot of moments when it gives you a real insight. I mean, was it a podcast I was listening to a few weeks ago? I don't know whether it was you guys or not. There's a bit where you hear Paul singing that Buttercup song.
Oh, Build Me Up Buttercup.
Yeah. Somebody made a joke about, well, hopefully there's more takes of Build Me Up Buttercup or something. But no, it's fine. I mean, this is just why it's interesting to see the film, because in the movie, Paul's about to lose it. He's about to break down and cry. And he's breathing heavily. And Linda's beside him, and she grabs his arm and holds it tightly. And he almost does it like a mentor. He goes, "Build me up, Buttercup, baby, build me up." And he's doing it to stop the tears. He's doing it to stop breaking down. Ringo's going, "Oh my God," and feeling upset. Michael's there, all go silent. And Paul's struggling to keep the tears back. And that's where "Build Me Up, Buttercup" is like a mentor. He's doing it to stop him breaking down. Stop breaking down. It's, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry.
Why do you build me up, Buttercup, baby?
I don't think you get that sense on the Niagara. You just hear them. There's certainly little specific moments like that where you guys will be very familiar with the audio and suddenly you'll see the pictures and you go, "Oh my God, that's completely different to what I had in mind would be happening at that time." Yeah.
That's the morning they come back on the 13th after the weekend.
The Build Me Up Buttercup, that's on the day. Well, yeah, I think we've got different language. Our vocabulary on this has been day one, day two, day three, day four. And we skip the weekend. So, you know, day two is a Friday and then Monday is day three. In our language, that's the Monday. That's the Monday after George leaves. It's day eight.
Yeah, the 13th.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
I was going to say that was the day they had the discussion before John and Yoko showed up, that the Yoko sat on an amp discussion.
Yeah. Same day. Yeah. There's some interesting stuff there. I'm not going to spoil it for you. There's stuff where there's no sound on the Niagaras, but the pictures are pretty powerful. You can have a look at it. I don't want to spoil it. I've already spoiled the Buttercups thing. There's more of it. You just have a look. That's a good example where there's literally periods of that conversation where there's no audio, nobody's saying anything. I mean, I think the tapes are running, but there's silence. And what's happening on those pictures is pretty, I mean, it actually probably will make you cry. It makes me cry every time I see it. So
I'm getting chills just listening to what you've described to this point. What was cool that we've talked about on the show before, and again, the people who have studied this are well familiar with the exchange between John and Paul, where Paul's leaning on John about, "So you're going to come up with some material?" And he goes, "We're going to work on something this weekend."
That's another good example. Yep. Carry on.
Well, I was going to say, having now just seen the visual to it, nothing at all like what I envisioned.
Oh,
at
have
all.
You seen it?
Somewhere. I don't know if it was in the 60 Minutes piece or where, but where they're both looking up as they're having that exchange.
Yeah. Well, what happens is it's actually quite interesting, the bit leading up to that, because it's a bit they're talking about the feedback, shut this feedback off. And it's just after I Mean Mine has been played. George has played I Mean Mine to the guys. And soon after that, anyway, and there's feedback and everything else. John is standing over by like a table with a cup of tea or something on it, or something. And you see Paul pacing, and now that we know what he's about to do, you see him being nervous, and he's like one of those things where I've got to talk to this guy, I've got to talk to him, I've got to have a hard word with him. Okay, I'm going to wait for the moment. I don't want anyone around. Okay, right, I'm going to move in now. He moves in, and the first two or three words or lines, you know, it's like, "So are you going to come up with some more stuff? We're going to face a crisis." And then both guys realize that bloody Michael Lindsay Hogg swings this boom mic over their heads. The serious conversation gets underway. Like Paul and John just get underway. Paul finally plucks up the courage to confront him. And John said, "What?" You know, what? And then they both realize that there's this bloody mic above their heads, and they both look up and start clowning around, and they finish the conversation, but they're doing it to the microphone now because they realize they've been sprung, you know, they've been sprung by the cameras and the mic. So in a weird way, Michael was filming it just fine. He didn't have to swing that thing in because we could hear it and see it before. You know, it was really the swinging into this boom mic, which wasn't actually required because the audio is perfectly clear without it. But they noticed it, and that sort of, it would have been nice if that hadn't happened, because then we would have just got the serious version of the conversation all the way through. But they start hamming it up and clowning around halfway through.
So. And again, you draw a different interpretation of that. Absent that visual, and you just hear the audio and John being silly, you can interpret as him deflecting Paul's very serious demand of him. But here they're both kind of changing course once they recognize they're becoming self-conscious.
I think just before they see the mic coming, I think John prods them in the chest. I think Paul comes up and says, "So when, you know, something, I forget, you know, so when are you going to come up with another song?" And John turns around and he does a prod in the chest. He says, "What? What?" Yeah, poof, you know, not seriously, not like aggressively, but just like a, like you do to make, "What are you saying?" And then at just that point, the boom mic swings in. Yeah.
I was wondering, because we discussed this on the show before about how if all you know of the Let It Be project is what you heard on the Nagras, which is a lot of discussion between 30 takes of Long and Winding Road, but what you've seen in the film, and that includes your sneak peek last year and other stuff that surfaced, Winter of Discontent, Bootleg, things like that. It's almost like night and day. You get the more serious, intense discussions through the audio, and all the visual seems to be, a lot of it is goofing around and clowning and things like that. Did you get a sense, and obviously you've seen way more and you've caught some, what you've already described in this conversation, some amazing, moving, serious moments. Did you get much of a sense that when they recognized they were being filmed, that they went on and just started acting for the cameras rather than naturally?
At times, yeah. At times. Yeah. I mean, I've been in that situation myself because, you know, when filming Lord of the Rings, all these things where they have these behind the scenes crew, a couple of kids with VHS cameras whose job it is to film the behind the scenes because, you know, eventually they cut together the making of things. And so, you know, I'm trying to direct the movie, and what happens, and it happens to me, and I think I can see it happening to them, is at the beginning, if you're sort of starting and you start this, I'm talking about me now, you start directing this movie and you're told, okay, there's these two kids going to film, okay. The first day or two, you're kind of very aware of them. You're keeping them in the corner of your eye. And you're sort of, you know, not all the time. You sometimes forget they're there. But by the time you're a week or two into it, they become more and more invisible and you've got more and more problems to deal with. And they become part of the furniture. You know, they become part of the scenery. So I think, you know, I mean, put it this way, I get more sense at Twickenham of them being hyper aware of the camera at times, not all the time, at times. And then as it goes along the Savile Row, you sort of think either they don't care anymore or they're not even aware of it or they're not thinking about it, you know. You're sort of, it actually that lessens as it goes along. And I think it's just a natural thing because you just forget about it. I mean, there's times where, and it's same to me, with you're talking to somebody and suddenly that you're at the corner of your eye, you realize, not this person's filming me doing it. I mean, of course, it changes your behavior slightly. You're sort of kind of, and you get these quite funny bits where Paul's the most hyper aware. So there's a lot of things where Paul's doing something and his eyes flick straight at the lens. And, you know, it's like one of those things where you flick and then back again. You're just kind of, he's aware of it. But there's also other times when he's certainly not. And Michael, I talked to Michael about it, and he said that, and I think the conversation on day eight, the Yoko sat on an amp stuff, I think a lot of that they didn't know they were being filmed. Because a lot of it, the cameras are on tripods. Well, they are for a lot of the filming anyway. But I think Michael said that quite often, and I think that's an example, they'd load up the cameras with 10-minute rolls of film. That's what they could hold. They had bigger magazines on the rooftop, but in Twickenham and Savile Row, they just had 10-minute long loads. And so they'd load a camera up. They'd put a bit of tape over the red light, because when you power up, they're not video cameras, but when you put the power on a 16mm camera, the red light come on. So they'd put a bit of tape over it. And this is mainly when the Beatles are just sitting around in a circle. They're not obviously moving around. They're just there. And the cameraman would flick the button on and they'd go across to the table and have a cup of tea. And so if the Beatles are looking up, if they're in a private conversation like that Yoko one, and they're glancing, are we being filmed or not? All they see is a camera sitting there, no apparent clue that they're rolling, and the cameramen are over there somewhere drinking cups of tea. So Michael employed, and this is where he deserves a huge credit that he never, ever gets. He employed a lot of tricks too, because all the things you're talking about are they aware they're being filmed, Michael was doing every trick in the book to try to film them when they weren't aware that they were being filmed. And I'm forever grateful to him for that. He was pretty clever at doing that. And he also did the whole, you know, microphones everywhere. And he had this bloody boom mic I mean, it's a huge big thing. It's a thing on wheels, a big wheel with a great big, you know, 10 or 12 foot arm with a mic. But when something's above your head, you're not, you tend to not know it's there, especially when you're looking at each other. And this thing would be forever sort of swinging. And occasionally when McCartney sees it, he grabs it and he swings it away. He like shoves it away, you know, but that's only a minimal amount of time. Most of the time they're either aware it's there and they know it's there and they think about it, or the other half of the time they don't. And also, you know, the conversation in Let It Be with the old famous George Paul thing, I'll play anything or I won't play at all. The reason why that's so soft is it annoys me that it's out of focus, because we have it in our movie the same as Michael had it in a Let It Be. George is out of focus. And that's because when that discussion, debate was beginning to hot up, Michael pushed his cameras as far away as he possibly could so they weren't aware of them. And they had these zoom lens, you know, they could sort of zoom in from a long way away. And in those days, you know, unless you were really careful with your focus, you zoom in right to the long end of the zoom where you're sort of a maximum telephoto on a dark room, unless you're absolutely precise, which these camera guys weren't particularly, you're going to get it a bit out of focus. Now, if you want it sharp, you have a wider end and you have the camera nearer, and the zoom lens is wider, and so it's just the depth of field is better and sharper. But that conversation soft and out of focus because Michael kind of quietly signaled his camera guys to drag the cameras a long way away. So the cameras were so far away in the dark and the gloominess of the studio because they were under all these lights. That's how that conversation happened without them being really aware that they were being filmed. Although you do see Paul and George sort of, because they've got their vocal mics, because they're obviously doing some rehearsal, and they turn the vocal mics away, you know, as that thing starts to sort of, because they don't want to be recorded. But I think Michael's got his boom over their heads and they've forgotten about that. Because the sound, the audio is pretty good.
Yeah, and that's a scene that we've talked about that has been given so much weight by the edited portion that's in Let It Be. Everybody sees that, and they themselves in court in the Paul lawsuit were just trying to spin that into that's the reason why George walked out was because of this dispute with Paul and musical differences. And
then the Beatles themselves use it in the anthology.
Right, exactly.
And it still becomes the focus.
I talked to Ringo. I said, can you tell me about why George walked out recently? And he said, you see why he walked out. It's in Let It Be, that thing where he and Paul are having an argument. And then he got up and he walked out. I mean, Ringo's memory is of him walking out at the tail end of that. That's the power of seeing a movie in 1970 when your band is breaking up and you're terribly stressed and upset. And the combination of seeing the movie with this, probably one of the most stressful and upsetting times of your entire life up to that point, it's just created a false memory. In legal terms and crime and courts, they always talk about some sort of false memory syndrome or something. I don't really even understand it. But I started to argue with Ringo. I started to say, no, you're wrong. It's on this and that. And then he said, no, I'm right. And then I just, this is not an argument. I'm ever going to win. So I sort of backed away, you know.
Have you seen that interview with George, I think, from Crawdaddy in 77, where he's describing the Let It Be film. And he talks about me and Paul were trying to have a fight on camera. And we do that. And then he goes, next shot, Yoko sitting in my seat. Well, as we know, that's not in Let It Be, but maybe it was in Michael Lindsay Hogg's earlier cut, and that's what he's remembering.
It was in his earlier cut. He did have a bit of that post-George leaving. Don't know whether he had a bit of George actually saying, I'm leaving the band now, but he had a bit of that Yoko jamming thing, and it was cut out. You guys have a look at it. You have a look at it on Disney Plus, because I think I might be wrong. I might be talking out the top of my head, because it's been a while, but I studied that jam after lunch, and I think Yoko's sitting beside his blue cushion. I'm pretty sure I was looking. I couldn't be definitive now, but you'll be able to look at it yourself, because most of the camera angles are in there. I mean, she sits down and she does her thing, and so she doesn't sort of move around. I don't think she's sitting on his little precious blue cushion. I think she's sitting on the rostrum beside it. I think it's right beside it, to be honest with you. But you just check it out. I can't remember, but whatever I've seen is in the cut. You'll see it too. I don't think she's actually. I don't think she's technically on it. She's she's 18 inches to the side of it.
Right. And then Michael Lindsay Hogg, after that, tells the cameraman, get a shot of the, yes, of the cushion.
Oh, he gets many shots of the cushion. Believe me, the cushion gets huge amount of coverage. He sees endlessly shooting the cushion. He's fascinated by the vacant blue cushion. Yeah. And John, of course, at some point says, take it away, George, when they're doing that jam. And he's like, kind of the blue cushion. Yeah. That's a lot of humor. the psychology of that after lunch when George is gone is really interesting. I read it. This is not definitive. This is my impression. Everyone has a different impression, I guess. But my impression is these are northern scouse boys, macho-y sort of boys, not used to dealing with emotions of any description. And they come back in a fairly aggressive kind of way. I'm so pissed, says John. It's like they're sort of angry at George going to some degree, and they go into this nutty heavy metal. I mean, you've heard it. I think this is one case where hearing it is probably, you can imagine the pictures, and it's probably pretty accurate. They go into the crazed sort of heavy metal-y kind of thing, and Yoko jumps in and all that. And I just think that's some hits, guys. That's bravado. It's a sort of bravado. They've had a shock, and how do they deal with the shock? They're pushing their emotions away and just kind of coming at it like they're coming out of a Liverpool bar when they're 15 years old and there's a bunch of teddy boys there. And it's like they're kind of, you know, it's sort of a bit of that. But then, as I say, as the afternoon wears on, that bravado kind of seeps away, drains away. You can see they're pretty distressed by the time the day ends.
There's a lot of references in the Sulpy book periodically throughout that intimate that they're drinking an awful lot of wine throughout these. And it's something, minus the visual, you have no way of knowing. But you can sort of infer it by maybe the way their speech starts to slur or the way the performances are coming off. Did you find further evidence of that?
One of the criticisms, yes and no. One of the criticisms I have of the Sulpy book is that there's a bit of some of the editorializing, which I'd call editorializing. You listen and you paint a picture. I think sometimes he gets that wrong unfairly. It's like, I mean, look, I can't remember an exact example, but the sort of thing is, you know, John's clearly had enough of this and decides to move on to another song. Or clearly, John's had enough of Paul doing Teddy Boy and you know, makes some snake around, moves on. You know, he sort of makes assumptions or editorializes. When you see it, it's not in the slightest bit true. If it's true on any level, they're clowning around and having fun. However, the drinking, they generally, most days, almost every day, they have happy hour, which we have not when we're shooting a movie. We don't have alcohol on the set, but when we're in the office or something at 5 o'clock, 5:30, you sometimes have happy hour and a bottle of wine comes out and you have a glass of wine. That happens most days. I mean, there's certainly, so I'm not saying that there certainly is wine drinking, but it's towards the end of the day. It's like the last hour of the day and it's not, they don't get pissed or anything. There's times when Sulpy says they come back from lunch and they've clearly been drinking, which I don't agree with them on. But there is two occasions where they do get pissed. One of them is, see, I'm just trying to remember my days now. It's the last day in part two, which is day 16, which is a Saturday. It's Saturday. It's the day before Heather McCartney comes in and they do the rock and roll songs and all that. It's the day where they've gone up and done the recce on the rooftop, actually. And they come back, and at the end of the day, they're doing Let It Be. And it's incredibly funny because they decide to, they're going to sort of, you know, do some more. They're not trying to record it particularly, but they're trying to do more work on the structure of the song, solos, you know, it's the solos and verse, chorus, chorus, verse, verse. And they're drinking Scotch and Coke. And they're drinking, and the happy hour starts a little bit too early. It's not wine, it's Scotch and Coke, and they get a bit too keen on it. And by the time that's underway, they're all, certainly Paul is at the piano almost pretty sozzled. John has had a bit too much. George is pretty tipsy. Ringo, I don't think, has drunk anything at all other than tea. But it's very, very funny. The more tipsy they get with the Scotch and Cokes, the funnier they are. They're very, very humorous. John yells out all sorts of insults to Paul about Let It Be. Paul's laughing. He's right. Okay, that's it. Roll that roll. We're going to do a great one here. We're going to do a great one. You read Doug's book, and he says that, you know, and this is what follows. And he's not really playing the drunken thing. He says, you know, what they do is a single most worst performance of Let It Be ever. He's criticizing them. Well, it's fun, and you see it because they're totally pissed. Paul says, oh, I'm a bit tired. I think we better pick this up tomorrow. But it's actually very sweet. It's very sweet and very, very funny. There's nothing wrong with it. It's quite humorous.
John, the second verse has two choruses. The first one we have 3 minutes.
Song.
Okay, again.
get Billy a third one. So you'd be quite powerful, even if just, you can rule out it.
It's just when it...
Hello.
It's a bit funny that because I think
he's going to be battling around like Wilson Pickett, you know. So if we just get
just like Wilson Pickett,
he'd probably turn into it.
And the other one is surprisingly I don't know the day that they record Don't Let Me Down. They actually did the version that's on the B side about 2 days before The Rooftop. They're pretty sozzled when they do that performance. So whenever you hear, I mean, have a look at it in the movie. Whenever you hear that Don't Let Me Down on that 45, they're pretty half cut when they're doing that. It's quite funny. George Martin comes in, says to them, he's sort of trying to sort of get them to stop clowning around because they're clowning around because they're a bit drunk. And he says, look, we can't, you know, George Martin comes in like the school teacher, and John Lennon jumps up and he says, I've had a few to drink, George. Remember Bob Wooler? Remember Bob Wooler? he's doing it in a very, very funny way. It's a very jokey way. Peace on earth, peace on earth. And he says, So I would nominate, if from what I've seen, I'd nominate those two times. And they're not the whole day. I mean, I'm talking about the Let It Be thing is at the very end of the day. It just happens to be scotch and coke instead of wine. And the Don't Let Me Down day, they're drinking pretty early on, from about lunchtime onwards, I'd say. Yeah, but it's harmless. God, it's not anything bad about it. There's a couple of times when I suspect, and none of this is on film, none of it's mentioned, but I suspect at Savile Row, a couple of times they've probably gone off into the loo and had a joint, I think. There's a couple of little patches where they're very, very giggly. And it's very funny. These guys are very funny when they – and I just wonder, I think, God, I suspect they've had a little puff of something because they're very, very giggly and childish for a short while. You know, you get the odd sense of that, but who cares, you know. Who cares? It's only very. It's just minimal. It's not all day. It's not every day. It's not nothing. It's just odd little patches. You know. And then obviously there's John. John has a couple of bad days in Twickenham where he's certainly taken something the night before that he shouldn't have done. There's no doubt about that. So you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that on that subject. If in all the visuals you've been able to collate together, the one thing that we know is the two junkies interview. With him and
Yoko. Yeah, you know, sure. I know that one too. We don't see that. I mean, we could have gone to Canadian TV and got the rights to it. Maybe we couldn't. I don't know. We didn't try it. We just wanted to stick with what Michael shot. But you see John. I mean, John comes back. I just thought it was better to be let John tell us rather than us have the two junkies interview. I just thought, let's not be voyeurs like that. John comes back and says, I was just sick on TV. You know, I had something last night I shouldn't have done. I'm abusing my body. I mean, John, you know, let John actually just tell us and own up to it. Michael doesn't film any of that. I was wondering whether Michael would actually get a wide shot of the Canadian camera crew talking, but he actually doesn't. What I think happens, when you look at the cut at our movie, there's a bit where the other guys are sitting in chairs in the corner somewhere, and they wheel in these big trains from the Magic Christian. These supply, well, they're just unfinished wooden things on wheels. These a big train carriage comes in, and they wheel this thing through the big door of the studio, because they need to put the Magic Christian sets, because the Magic Christian is going to have to move into the studio pretty damn soon. So they start wheeling in a sort of unfinished train carriage with the other guys. We're not with John and Yoko, who are somewhere else. We don't see them. But they're in the same studio, and the other guys have some jokes about that and talk about making a movie and all this sort of stuff, which is what we see in our film. And looking at the two junkies interview, there's a bit where they get interrupted by a noise, and it's like, and John says, oh, sorry, folks, there's a bit of activity happening off camera here, sorry. Sorry, folks, and I think that's probably when the trains are getting wheeled, and I think that's where you would sync those two up. I think what John is being distracted by with the crew moving around, the noise, is probably these two train carriages getting moved in, which Michael is filming, but you don't see John and Yoko in the actual shot, and nor do you see the train carriages in the two junkie shots. So, but I think that's probably where the two line up, I suspect.
Wow, that's amazing. The Peter Sellers drop-by visit, do we see much of that in your cut?
I keep forgetting now. I some of this was edited so long ago, I forget how long the original one is. I mean, yeah, I mean, we've got about, I don't know, 3 minutes, 3 or 4 minutes off of him. I mean, he comes and goes pretty quick in the original thing. There's probably more of it in the uncut thing. But, yeah, you see him come and very awkward and says a few things. He leaves reasonably quick. We probably make him leave a little bit quicker than what he did. We probably have 3, 4, 5 minutes of it. And I mean, it might have been 10 or 15 minutes in the original one. But you know, we didn't want to spend 10 or 15 minutes sitting and looking at Peter Sellers squirming around. You get the idea with 5 or 6 minutes. See, that's what I was having to do when I went some of this editing down. You get the idea. Okay, we get it. We get it. We understand. And seeing another 10 minutes of it doesn't tell us anything new that we, you know, there was no other, especially when it's just like that, there's not actually any hard information that we're interested in. It's just more of the same, that type of thing. So, yeah. I'm the most recent director, Peter Sellers. I actually just suddenly realized I've got Peter Sellers on my CV now, which I never thought of my life I'd have. And we had to pay. We had to pay his family like £20,000 or something. Peter Sellers got paid to be in Get Back. So that's just the way things go. I don't know what it was. It wasn't £20,000. It was something anyway. It was a reasonably fair sum, I thought. But I mean, he should get paid. You know, families do own the rights of their dear and beloved if they're actors, you know, the estate. Because you can't have an actor die like that and then you can just grab clips of them and put them in any old thing. The estate obviously still controls that. And we had to ask their permission to include it as well, so which they gave us. So.
What about the Dick James visit, the day that George left?
That's there. It's quite a long scene. I mean, it won't be as long as the original, but it pretty much touches all the bases that the original full one does. They quote a lot of song titles from the catalogue, but they don't quote all the song titles. I tended to pick the more funny ones. Something about a baby dying in a cradle, and
oh yeah, a lot of World War One. Yeah,
there's a few of those titles are really funny. So I tended to, you know, since I couldn't, you just didn't want to sit there and use them all. I picked the funny one. But you also hear about him, the catalogue. You hear the bit about when Paul says, and you know, when he says something about you guys own half of this, own this catalogue now, and Paul says not really, Dick, or something, and Dick gets all awkward, and oh, we should have lunch on this sometime. All that's in there, yeah, for sure. This is where it gets interesting, because you guys are going to know who Dick James is, and people who know are going to know. I thought about it, but I didn't stop the whole movie and explain to the average viewer who Dick James is. I called a music publisher or something, Northern Songs, and it's clearly a bit of an awkward conversation. You get the idea that John sort of ignores them completely. He just doesn't want to really, almost. He gets excited. John only engages when Dick says that Vera Lynn's doing Fool on the Hill or something. And John's excited.
Yes, he's doing Good Night.
Yeah, Good Night. And John says, and he turns to Yoko and says, it's the great Vera Lynn. And he's kind of, you know, as an English guy, Vera Lynn's like a goddess if you went through the war, you know. So that's the only time that John really engages with Dick James. It's clear sometimes the subtext tells you a lot, where John clearly has no interest in chatting with Dick James in the slightest. And Dick James kind of knows it. Paul sort of does it because Paul is the diplomat who is not going to be rude to Dick James, but he's sort of on the edge of being rude.
Right. Had you seen that footage that Apple shot in June of 68 where he is?
Yeah, I've seen all that, yeah. Have you seen the entire thing with the outtakes and stuff? I've seen like an hour. They shot it for about 30 minutes. Paul and John give him a hard time. I tell you, they really tear into him. And he kind of stands his ground, you know. It's sad. It's just, you know, it's all very awkward, really. But I thought it was a bit unfair that they were filming Dick James, to tell you the truth. They keep saying to him, he said, why am I being filmed? What's all that? They keep saying, oh, we're doing an Apple promo film, Dick, and don't worry, you'll see it. And if you don't want it in there, we can take it out. But they're still rolling, and he's still having this, and they're going at him. He's got nowhere to run or hide, and he's being filmed. And I kind of feel, well, you sort of ambushed the guy, really, to some degree. But however, historically, all these years later, it's pretty amazing that it actually ended up on film.
Yeah, and speaking of amazing, and I'm pretty sure this made it to your cut, but you can tell us, but the Alan Williams visit.
Well, oh no, I'm going to, it's embarrassing. Yes and no, it was in our cut once, and then it got taken out of the cut. And there's one shot of him. I think in the trailer you do see one or two shots of him. It was one of those things that we took out when it all just got too long. I mean, it's a shame. I'd put it back again. If we do an extended cut, I'd stick it back. The most interesting thing with Alan James, with the Alan Williams visit, as you guys know, you've heard all this stuff, is the discussion about the Summertime disc, the song from Hamburg, where he says, oh, I forgot, I meant to bring in that disc with you guys, and I forgot. He forgot to bring it in because, of course, a few days later or a few weeks later, he loses it. However he loses it, I don't know, he leaves it on
a cab or something, yeah, or a party.
Something, yeah. And so if he remembered to bring it in, because I think he was going to loan it. I don't know whether it's to Ringo. I mean, I think Ringo was the one that was interested in it. If he'd remembered it, then it would exist today, and it would probably have been on the anthology. Just, you know, we would have heard it if Alan had remembered to bring it in. But you see, then I thought, well, if I have this stuff, I'm going to have to stop and explain the summertime. I'm going to have to explain it. And, you know, and there's a nice photo of the label that exists, which is a nice one. Well, when you see the movie, it was a point in the film where, because of other things that were going on, it just didn't feel right to kind of stop dead and do that. But it's a perfect extended cut sequence if we ever do an extended cut, which is not by no means guaranteed. So
that's interesting you say that, because originally it was announced that it would be the 3 2-hour segments on Disney Plus, and like in the last week, it's suddenly almost up to 8 hours now.
I'll tell you why that happened, because it was 6.5 hours earlier this year, and that's what the Beatles saw, and when they saw the first cut, so it was the first thing that time they saw the finished thing. They liked it and everything, and we showed it to Disney. And then it became, we watched it a few times, and it just felt a bit too long. And we spoke to Disney, and they said, well, yeah, you know, it'd probably be better at 6 hours. Well, 6.5, so better at six hours. We trim it down. So we trimmed it down. That might have been when Alan Williams got lost, tried to lose half an hour out of it. And, you know, when I sort of agreed that it did play better at 6 hours, and we were still just working and polishing it, you know, polishing the cut. And then a conversation happened where I started to talk to Disney about the extended cut. And this is Disney, not so much Apple, because Disney are the ones that say yes and no for an extended cut, because they essentially have the rights to do what they want. It's, you know, Apple have the sort of the creative rights. Apple can say we don't want, you know, this or that in the film. But in terms of what they're going to, you know, no, you can't force Disney to sell something if they don't want to sell it. And Disney said, because they are talking about a Blu-ray of the Disney Plus version that you're going to see at some point next year, that will come out. I don't know when, but it'll come out on Blu-ray. But and so I was saying, well, you know, after that, because what you'd usually do, you do that, and then 6 months later or whatever, you do it, an extended cut comes out. I was saying to them, well, we should start thinking about the extended cut now, because we've got all the footage. We're in the editing room. We're finishing up the 6-hour version, and, you know, we can start thinking about the, even though it might be a year or 18 months away, at least now's the time to start looking at it. And I was a bit shocked when Disney said, well, we're not going to do an extended cut. And I said, why? And they said, well, there's no market for it. Nobody is buying extended cuts anymore. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. They said that that's what the case. I'm sure they would do extended cuts on their movies if they could sell them. So they're probably right.
I'll give you my credit card right now.
Well, I thought they're right for Marvel films, they're right for Star Wars, but they're not necessarily right for the Beatles. You know, if people would buy Beatles extended cuts. But anyway, I didn't agree with it, but I don't have the power over that stuff. And so, unfortunately, their mistake was to tell me there wasn't going to be an extended cut when I still had 2 or 3 months editing time. So I said to Jabez, my editor, I said, well, they're not going to be an extended cut, Jabez. Let's just put what stuff that we've cut out. And it wasn't so much that I said, let's just do another run through the rushes, because it was digging back into the rushes again. Because every time you look at them, you understand more and more, because you've been cutting stuff. Some comment that you ignored, you know, a year ago when you last heard it. Now that you've edited this other stuff, suddenly this comment means something that it didn't mean back then, but because it's like, you know, we hadn't cut this when we heard that comment a year ago, but now we've cut this, that remark suddenly has a significance. So it's always worth just keep going back into the old stuff and looking at it again. Because so I did that with, and I said to Jabez, look, what we have to do is just forget length. We were, you know, it was always 6 hours. We were adding stuff and had to take stuff out to keep the balance of 6 hours. But I said, let's just do this, and there's not going to be an extended cut, so stuff the length. You know, just stuff the length. Let's just do it. And we didn't tell Disney, we didn't tell the Beatles, we didn't tell Apple, we didn't tell anybody we were doing this. They were all expecting a 6-hour cut. And Jabez and I just knuckled down and for the last 2 or 3 months just put in everything that we had. Well, no, it wasn't everything we'd taken out. It was actually just looking at what we hadn't ever really put into it. We did a whole other dive into the original rushes again, and we pulled out all sorts of interesting stuff that I hadn't realized was important before, and we started putting it all in, and it ended up being nearly 8 hours. And so when we had to deliver them the final film, they were expecting 6 hours. They got eight hours, and nobody said a thing. Nobody made a single comment. No one picked up the phone and said, hang on, this is actually eight hours long. Not Apple, not the Beatles, not Disney, nobody. Nobody always talked about it. But you see, I think the 8-hour version plays better than the 6-hour one, because most of the 2 hours that we added in was really hardcore story stuff. And I found a conversation that I never really paid much attention to on the second day. I mean, it's there. It's been there all the time. And I heard it a long time ago, but I just somehow it glossed over me, where they're talking about Ray Charles and how Ray Charles' boy, Billy, is such a great player, and Ray doesn't play the organ anymore. Ray's, you know, he just says, "Oh, the my lad Billy can do all that." And I must have heard that way, way back. And I know all about Billy Preston, but some reason I just didn't compute, or maybe it didn't have any pictures with it. So I sort of was focusing on the stuff that had pictures. And so we went, and we, you know, we found this bit when we found it was there all the time. But we, and it was like, well, that's obviously got to go in because Billy Preston's going to show up in Savile Row. So on the second day at Twickenham, they're talking about how great Billy is. Of course, you put it in. So we just went, we did a whole deep dive back into everything, and we found all these little bits and pieces that help with the storytelling, and that's where a lot of the 2 hours came from. So that's why I really think that the 8 hour version actually plays better. It's a better narrative than a 6 hour one because it got all those extra little storytelling bits and pieces put into it that we didn't have before.
Right, know? All these setups for things that are going to get paid off down the road.
Yeah,
that's fantastic, Tom.
The thing with this movie has been a bit like, you know, when I was a kid, we used to drive a car up the road a few miles, and there was a big bridge, a big sort of concrete bridge that used to drive over a river. And I remember my mother telling me, "Oh, your uncle used to paint. Used to paint this bridge, and you know what? He'd start at one end with a can of paint, and he'd spend 3 years painting the bridge, and then by the time he got to the end and he finished it, he had to go back to the beginning again and start to paint it again. 3 years later, the bit he started on is all dirty and crappy and peeling, and he had to go back. And it's a bit like this. You go through all this footage, listen to it, and then you realize, well, now that I've got to the end, there's probably stuff at the beginning I didn't have a clue what they were talking about, but I probably will now because I've heard this stuff. So you go back to it again, and you start all over again, and you go through it again. It's been a bit like that. You just keep looping through it. While you're looping through it, you've got to actually try to cut the film at the same time as well. So it's you've got to actually stop and cut certain scenes. You can't sort of do that all the time. So often, you know, I'd work with Jabez Olsen, my editor. I mean, there's two of us in a room, and we'd be editing in the day, and I had it all on my iPad, and I'd come home at night as much as I could and spend 2 or 3 hours just looking at some of the old rushes to, you know, so I wasn't chewing up time in the cutting room doing that and whatever, you know. It's been quite intense the last few years.
Said to the immigrants, "You better get back to your Commonwealth homes." Yeah, yeah, yeah. He said, "You better get back home." Now Enoch Powell, he said to the folks, he said, "You knew the color of your skin." He said, "You don't care what it's all about." So Ted, he said to Enoch Powell, he said, "You better get out, or is he gonna try?" Is Enoch Powell, "Enoch, you better go home." So Wilson said to Dubrovnik, "Come on, boy, we gotta swing. We gotta go back to the summit of the hill, and Betty is gonna sing." So Enoch Powell said to Wilson Heath, "By you, Commonwealth."
"Commonwealth, yes. Commonwealth, yes. Commonwealth, yes. Commonwealth, yes.
If you don't want trouble, then you better go back to home."
So I went to Pakistani, I went to India, I went to Calcutta, and I don't even know that. I'm coming back, yes, to England town. Yes, welcome. And Dirty Enoch Powell, and he's had enough of Carlin men. A Commonwealth, yes. Commonwealth, yes. A Commonwealth, yes. Can you hear me, Commonwealth, yes?
Well, ain't an Enoch Powell that you gotta go. Well, I checked up to Australia, I sent to New Zealand. You better call me with us, we're gonna have some fun. We're going up to India, we're going to Pakistan. We're going up to Europe, gonna be alright. And you know Powell and he sticks his foot in. He said, "You got a trouble, you're going to be alright."
Oh, Commonwealth, yeah.
Oh, Commonwealth,
yeah.
Yeah,
Commonwealth, yeah.
Oh, hear me talking, Commonwealth. Commonwealth, but it's much too wealthy for me.
Much too common for me.
come for me. Oh, yeah. I traveled down Australia and New Zealand, too. I went up to Pakistan and India, too. I came back to West Indies and I had a cricket match. I went to South Africa and traveled to the patch. Oh, Commonwealth, you must do Commonwealth. Everybody say, hey, Commonwealth. Immigrants Commonwealth. Yeah. Well, I would join the common market, but as much to Commonwealth.
Yeah.
Something About the Beatles. Created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez. Executive producer Rick Way. Title song by The Corgis.
There's more I want to add to this. In the great Peter Jackson tradition, we are doing this in three pieces, so you will be able to hear part two in a week, part three the week after that. But I also want to point out to anybody who might find this of interest, we are going to be posting on YouTube the video to the interview, and also other Sappy shows going forward, we're going to be posting on YouTube as well. So it's one more way you'll have access to the show. A lot of people have been asking about Spotify and why we're not on it. There were some issues with that. We were on it briefly, then we weren't. We're going to come back to it, and it's going to be under the name Something About the Beatles Raw. All that means is that it is the shows, the conversations, minus some of the production and the audio clips. And that will be a bit more of a streamlined show. But for some of you who like your podcast mean and lean, that'll be the way to go. Otherwise, the full-blown bells and whistle shows will be out there, as always, on all the platforms that they're on for the foreseeable future. But if you just want the dialogue, you'll be able to get it that way. Mean and lean. Something About the Beatles Raw. So subscribe to the YouTube channel, Fab4ConJam, where all the shows will be posted going forward. Also, follow us on Instagram, Something About the Beatles 1964. Follow us on Facebook for daily On This Day in History posts and news. And follow us on Twitter, Sappy Show is the Twitter handle, to be up to date on all the stuff that's going on, because there's going to be a lot of stuff going on. I will tell you now that the intent is to get more shows out regularly. They might be multi-parters. If we keep them down to around an hour in length, we'll just parcel them out like that. That way you can digest them quicker and I can turn them around faster. Hope that sounds good to you. Otherwise, happy holidays. We'll talk soon on the next installment next week. Peter Jackson, The Making of Get Back, 224B.